Hi, I'm Cantor Rosalie Will, and you're listening to Drinking and Droshing, Torah with a Twist. And I have a piece of music that has Amanda's name on it that Ellen Dreskin gave out during the Kutz Choir in God only knows what year.
Wait, hold on. I know that I'm not a Cantor, but it is one of our favorite episodes to record every single year. We've made it. We've made it to the sea. We've got lots of songs to sing, lots of music to talk about, and also a lot of incredible words on, say, leadership, group building, community organizing, all sorts of changes, being able to find a lot of special things in a story that we've come to know quite well. And so you've guessed it, we're at Parshat Beshalach, and we have our incredible Miriam songstresses with us today. We're so excited to introduce them to you. So I get to start first. Cantor Ellen Dreskin, ellendreskin.com, is a communal prayer leader, educator, spiritual director, and mentor in the areas of liturgy, worship, and spiritual practice. She educates toward a deeper understanding of prayers, both traditional and creative, and the act of prayer itself as a doorway into spiritual practice and transforming oneself in order to transform the world. Ellen has served as a scholar in residence at dozens of congregations across the country and as an educator and prayer ritual leader at numerous institutes, camps, and conferences, including the Institute for Jewish Spirituality, HUCJR, Song Leader Bootcamp, Hava Nishira, URJ Biennials, and the JCCA's Sheva Center for Early Childhood Education. I do note that she didn't write how many summers she taught me at Kutz, but that's fine. She teaches regularly online and is a regular co-host of Eliana Light's Light Lab podcast, taking deep dives into individual prayers and prayer-related topics. Ellen was ordained by HUCJR in 1986 and has a master's degree in Jewish communal service from Brandeis University. She is also trained as a spiritual director. She is married to Rabbi Billy Dreskin and is extremely proud of their joint projects, Katie, Jonah, Zikrono Livracha, and Aiden.
And it's now my turn to introduce our other awesome guest, Cantor Rosalie Will. Cantor Rosalie Will brings more than 25 years of experience in training song leaders, leading worship, and creating singing communities. After 17 years with Temple Emmanuel in Kensington, Maryland, she now consults congregations on issues of worship, music, and synagogue transition, and she mentors clergy in the field. She is founder and director of Sing Unto God Incorporated, a nonprofit dedicated to elevating the practice and promotion of meaningful worship and of singing together. She produces events which lead the cutting edge of worship and music thinking, trains communal singing professionals on best principles for communal singing, as well as singing for justice, and has published a narrative trade book with Transcontinental Music Publishing entitled Song Leading, A Work of Art. Rosalie also supports the Union for Reform Judaism, the URJ, on issues of worship and music. Rosalie was ordained from the Debbie Friedman School of Sacred Music of Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion in New York, which is my school, and served as vice president for member relations of the American Conference of Cantors. She is a product of URJ camps and NIFTY and received her undergraduate degree in Jewish studies from the University of Pennsylvania. She lives in a Maryland suburb of D.C. with her daughters and her partner. Welcome, Rosalie.
Thank you, Gabe. Your voice is so great. You should do all the introductions. I'm going to take you on the road to speak all the introductions. But I'm so honored to be here and with my dearest friend Ellen and having this conversation tonight. So thank you.
We are so thrilled to have you here. And I love it. Just as you said that Ellen is one of your dearest friends, Gabe is certainly one of my dearest friends. And so Gabe Snyder, co-host with The Co-Most and one of the best voices in podcasting history. How's it going, buddy?
I'm pretty good. How are you doing?
I'm very excited to be here. I'm so stoked always to be surrounded by very talented musicians. And speaking of, we have one of those on our podcast crew as well. How's it going, executive producer Edon Waldman?
It's going great. Happy to be here with everybody. I'm really excited.
So am I. And you don't even have to play guitar tonight if you don't want to.
I suppose I don't.
But for those listening, he does teach guitar lessons so that people learn how to play guitar and continue spreading music. Hashtag Edan rules the world. We are so excited to continue on our journey to RC, maybe getting across it and singing some songs. Let's get started.
Last week in Bo, after 10 plagues and a whole bunch of back and forth, Pharaoh finally let the people go. I'm sure that will last a long time. So God takes the mixed multitude on the scenic route out of Egypt, through the wilderness at the Sea of Reeds. The people are guided by a pillar of cloud by day and fire by night. Oh, by the way, Moses has Joseph's bones with him, which is cool because Joseph asked to be buried in his homeland, but then he got embalmed and put into a sarcophagus in Egypt, so now his wish is finally being fulfilled after 400 years. Nice continuity, Torah. After a bit of wandering, God has the Israelites make camp by the sea, and just in case you thought God was done with the whole heart-hardening thing, God once again hardens Pharaoh's heart, and Pharaoh directs his chariots to pursue the Israelites. The Israelites see the Egyptians in the distance, and they're all pretty tired and understandably frustrated with this whole will-he-won't-he situation going on, so they bicker for a while, but Moses says, "Don't worry, guys, it'll all work out." God directs Moses to lift his staff to part the sea, and the Israelites will march through on dry land while God continues to harden the hearts of the Egyptians that's causing their pursuit of the Israelites in the first place. Cool, that sounds reasonable. Good job, God. So the pillar of cloud that had been leading the people now moves behind them and shields the Israelites. Moses holds up his arm over the sea, and what do you know, it splits and the people walk on dry land in between the walls of water. When the people are through, God traps the Egyptians in between the walls of water and has Moses hold out his arm again to close up the sea. The waters turn back and the Egyptian horses and chariots and riders are flung into the sea, leaving none to escape. Upon realizing their freedom on the other side of the sea and seeing the washed-up corpses of their pursuers, gross, the Israelites are in awe of God's power. They sing, "I will sing to God because God's really great. Horse and rider, God hurled into the sea." Yes, that's a literal translation. Hey, who's that? It's Miriam, the sister of Aaron. Isn't she also Moses' sister? Whatever. Let's have a party to celebrate our freedom. Miriam sings, "Sing to God, y'all, because God's really great. Horse and rider, God hurled into the sea." Didn't we just read that? Anyway, Miriam picks up a timbrel, whatever that is, and all the women followed her with their own timbrels, and they all dance, and Miriam leads them in a fully choreographed musical number, complete with a tap break and kick line, probably. Once they're all danced out, they keep walking. They get to a place called Bitter, creatively named for its bitter water. The people bitterly bicker about the bitter, bitter water, but don't worry. The bitter bickering about the bitter water of Bitter is made better when Moses finds a stick to put in the bitter water in Bitter. So I guess you could say that the timber of Bitter betters the bitter bickering over the bitter, bitter beverage. I know I did that bit last year, but it's still funny. The people quickly find more things to complain about, so God rains some bread from the sky, also some other foods. Not really sure what it is, but it tastes good, kinda sweet. Let's call it manna. What's manna? Nothing. What's a manna with you? Hey, look, more complaining, this time about water again. God fixes it with a rock. That might be foreshadowing. Ah! It's the Amalekites! Don't worry, Moses, just keep up your hands. What, all day? Yup. He might need some help with that. Eventually, the Israelites finally manage to fend off Amalek. For now. And that's Parashat Beshalach.
Wow. So many groans and chuckles all in one brief telling of a Torah tale. I don't think that's ever happened to me before, that I've both groaned and chuckled when I'm hearing a Torah portion. So well done indeed.
Thank you. I do try to do my best. I do try to keep the balance between dad joke and just like irreverent, sarcastic ridiculousness. So I'm hoping I struck that balance for you today.
You thread the needle very well.
Thank you.
I can't say, man, this Torah portion is packed. It's packed with people behaving in very strange ways and God behaving in even stranger ways. I feel like we maybe should have mixed the drinks before we heard the story of the portion tonight.
Kendra Druskin, Kendra Will, we are so excited to have you here. And I know I am especially excited because I, you know, as I said before, I've literally gotten to learn from both of you so beautifully, either at Kutz when both of you were singing together, or, you know, when I, during the summer of 2020, enrolled in Kendra Will's web-based worship and really a hope to ensure that people were getting a strong, full, prayerful experience, right? And one of the things I remember Kendra Will talking about was that we were in a playground, you know, we were able to explore and experiment, and that was something that was really powerful. And so I have to say, neither one of you seem to be strangers to leading a community through change or through challenge or even through crisis. And I was hoping, would you be willing to share what inspired or helped shape your own brand of leadership?
I'd love to think of myself as a lifelong renegade. I don't know if others would agree with me, but from the time when I was a camper at Kutz Camp, I think I was using music to ruffle feathers and have an awful lot of fun. And that has followed me throughout. My first summer at Kutz Camp, we staged a production of Godspell. I was an RA. I was already a counselor at the time. The administration didn't like that one too much, but we had an awful lot of fun and some really good God discussions. I think that music is an agent for change and prayer. And I think that faith is an agent for change because the world is constantly changing. And what we believe about it, if that stays the same all the time, then we're in trouble. I think there's a lot of dysfunction and being stuck. And so I've always tried to use music to change the energy in a room, to build community where there is none, to give people a chance for quiet and silence and meditation when there's too much noise. Music is the most wonderful tool to have in your toolbox. And I think it motivates change and it helps to ease the discomfort of change at the same time.
I love that, Ellen, in part because I see you as a lifelong renegade as well, and an agitator in all the best ways. And Ellen was one of my teachers as well. The similar things drive me or create that sense of ongoing passion. But for me, a lot of it is this belief that singing together, that the sound a group makes together, has the power to save lives. That when we are less isolated, but can really build something together, can each contribute something, making the vibrator inside us create sound in some way and build that with others, that it creates a power and a strength to then move the world, to agitate for change and social justice, to help people find places for faith and for their belief. If created in safe spaces where everyone truly has a voice, I think singing together reminds us each that we have uniqueness and we have a voice to contribute, and that when we sing together, it doesn't work unless everybody's there. That the magic of the moment is because everyone's voice contributes. So I'm just driven by this idea that without communal song, in whatever form it takes, in prayer, in a camp, out in front of the steps of a courthouse, you know, working for change in some way, without singing together, I don't see how any of us really move forward in communities trying to build a stronger future. I can't see it happening without music, without singing together in some way.
It's interesting that you pick up on this theme of how music affects change or how music goes hand in hand with change. In fact, Ellen, you said something really interesting. You said that faith and change go hand in hand. not just music and change, but faith and change. And that struck me for a minute, because when I think about religion, I think about tradition. I think about, you know, the ancestral 2,000-year-old, 4,000-year-old tradition of the Jewish people. And I think about these, you know, ancient melodies and this, you know, Mycenae from Sinai tradition that we have. And yet, we also recognize the ways in which religion can pull us forward or push us forward. We recognize the places in our tradition, such as this Torah portion, where we recognize and we celebrate a huge shift, a huge change in our lives. So I think I'm curious for both of you, how do you strike that balance between respecting and revering and holding up and being a vessel of tradition while still being a renegade, breaking the mold, maybe not breaking the vessel, but certainly expanding it?
Well, Ellen thinks, it's interesting because I think about this portion actually as a great, there's two moments for me at least where I think this is exemplified. And one is in the places that actually speak to me most, and it's not Miriam in the singing, it's both the bringing of Joseph's bones, the taking imperative to bring our ancestors with us when we leave to go on this journey. And I find that very moving. And I think about that very much when I think about, you know, training a new generation of song leaders or of lifting up people who are leading, that we're always bringing the bones of the people who came before us and we stand on their shoulders with this moment of imagining the future of then crossing the sea and even then of Moses standing, as you said, you know, holding his arms out to make sure that group continued to win the war, but people had to come up and hold either arm to make sure when he wasn't able to hold his arms up the whole time that he was being held up by others. So this continuity of bringing the past with us while at the same time creating something new with the people who are there with new life and new energy, those two things speak to me the most in the portion. And I think are the ways that I would approach how we think about music or prayer or building communities, whether they're in congregations or outside congregations, is there's always a part of those traditions we're bringing with us, but who are we now as we stand on the other side of the sea? And what are the stories that we have to tell? They don't have to be brand new out of whole cloth, but they're the stories of our ancestors and they're the stories of what our experiences are now and what we're looking for the future. I think those don't have to be in conflict. In my experience, they don't have to be in conflict. And I think the most dynamic worship or ways that we sing together at camp or in other places are when we say, we have so much that we've brought with us, but we ultimately become translators of that repertoire, translators of our history into what matters to us in this moment. We translate all those experiences into maybe new languages or new formats or new forms or new iterations, but we bring it with us and then turn it, create it into something new. So I don't think they need to be in conflict so much, or they shouldn't be at least.
I'll jump off of that. I'm a big fan of both English and Hebrew language and word origin and gematria and numerology and things like that. And religion comes from the same root as ligaments. It's about connection. This is the soft material that connects the bones and the muscles and stretches and changes and adapts according to a human body's movements. And religion then is, I believe, in every single generation, reconnecting, call it to the source of life, the spring of whatever you want to call God, let's call it that. If in every generation that connection is not reestablished in a relevant way that people can fit into their big picture of what life is all about, then we're out of here. It's funny, we say terms like Mycenae and tradition, et cetera. There's a rabbi who's no longer alive, Arnold Jacob Wolf, Reform rabbi in Chicago, said to one of my teachers, and then it came through my teachers to me and other students, there's only one kind of Judaism. It's Torah, true, literal, over 2,000 years ago Judaism. That's the only true Judaism. Everybody since then has been a Reform Jew. The Talmudists already were trying to take Torah to a place where this is how it's going to fit into your lives. And every rabbi in every generation and every commentator, every Dvar Torah was finding a way to relate Torah to that generation and their challenges and their problems. And if religion stops reconnecting us to the bigger world and the universe and our own hearts, et cetera, then it really has no purpose. It just becomes, I think, something that we do because people used to do it. And I don't know that that's a good enough reason to do it, is because people used to. I'd much rather say, let's do it differently because we know what they got out of it. We know the gem that's hidden inside this ritual or this gift or this story. And we need to blow some today's air on it and reignite it.
It reminds me, Ellen, what Rabbi Larry Hoffman, our teacher, teaches about like the prayer book or our liturgy. And, you know, the word liturgy comes from the Greek of to work for the people. It's an active thing. It's not just static. It has to work for the people. And if it doesn't, it has to change. That isn't Larry, but Larry would say that the prayer book is the diary of a Jewish people. And none of us would like live the diary of our 12-year-old selves. It's a part of us. We might go back and read our diary and some of our essence is there, but we don't live the way we imagined the world when we were 12 or 20. It's just somebody's diary that we then have to become translators of and reformers to, making sure that it's relevant to us.
I think for me, one of the things that this kind of brings to mind is in our Torah portion in Exodus 13, we're told that God is generally traveling in front of the people. And there are two ways that God is traveling in front of the people, right? There is an Amud Anan, which is this idea of basically a pillar or column of kind of cloud-like material. And then there's Amud Esh. There's a column of fire. And each day, right, we have like kind of a revolving cloud fire, and it provides people what they need at the time that they may need it. And I used to say that for me, I love this idea of B'Tselem Elohim being created, you know, in the image of God, B'Tselem Elohim. But I always wondered what would happen if we were able to take that Tselem and focus on the Tzel, the shadow of God, that we were always kind of surrounded in some way or another by the light and shadow of God helping support us through these journeys, helping us as we change. And I know that both of you have said, you know, we don't always stay where we are. And Ellen, you referred to the fact that the people act in strange ways and God acts in strange ways. But I am curious how it feels to maybe have almost an anchor or an amud, right? Like a column to hold on to when we're constantly going through changes, and what that amud might look like for us, even as we are reforming the Judaism as we know it to make it relevant today and also to help us take ownership of it today.
Boy, I don't know how much time we have. I don't know. Can this like section of the podcast last for the next, I don't know, month or so, or until we actually get to Passover or anything like that? Amanda, if you want my honest to God response to that, that amud for me is whatever interpretation of Yud Heh Vav Heh or God is going on for a person. Or to hang on to that. I love the word echadity. I think that if you're going to, that's for me the one-ity, the unity of God. I like to call it the echadity. That's the constant, the universal, the eternal, as well as our internal core that we all share, that is the commonality and the connection. And that if we can keep that part of our tradition alive in every generation, then there is a constant there. I think that, you know, there's a great story of there's a new synagogue. A visitor comes to a synagogue from another country and sits down in the back row to observe the behavior of the congregants. And the congregants all walk down the aisle until they get to the sixth row. And then they bow and they take two steps forward with their knees bent. And then they continue down the aisle. Every single person walks in this way. And the visitor says to somebody, "What's up with the, you know, walking two steps bent over when you get to the sixth aisle. Is there something going on? And they said, oh, yeah, in our last building, there was a chandelier at the sixth row and it hung really low. And so now everybody, we're not in that building anymore. Most people don't even know the story, but everybody's still bowing in the sixth row. You know, eventually people are going to stop bowing. If you don't have the spirit, if you don't have the experience, the expression, the emotion behind the ritual, then the ritual is can be rather empty. In every generation, we, you know, reignite these mitzvot. We have to own them. They got to be ours. They can't be something that I got a lot of stuff in the trunk in my basement. That's not what I want my religion to be. I don't want it to be a museum. I don't want it to be something that's stored in formaldehyde to be preserved. No, it's got to be a lot more fun and a lot more active and integral to my life than that.
I love that. And I think about that story because I would be curious if in the next iteration of that story or the part two, the sequel, is that the community tells that story to everybody and make sure that it's known as the story of that community. Because for me, that amu, that anchor, and what is constant is the building of community through the telling of our stories to each other, of the way that we learn more about ourselves and each other and the world by sharing experiences that aren't our own, that are different from ourselves. So that, you know, and similar to what Ellen said about with the bowing and making sure that it feels like it has to have meaning, if not it's irrelevant, is because even when we think of tradition, there's no such thing as as tradition. Whose tradition are we talking about? Everybody's tradition is different because everyone has different lived experiences or lived in a different part of the world or had different context for their Jewish life if they were in a Jewish community and obviously if they were Jew adjacent or elsewhere. So we can't even identify a single tradition as it. We shouldn't talk about tradition as being a singular experience. So for me, that constant is a sense that the community is only as strong or as full of Jewish life and hope. It's only as strong as the stories that the people are telling within the community. If it's just blank faces and just, you know, amorphous crowds of folks, that's just not sustainable. But if, like in the story of the folks who bow at the sixth row, but if we're able to tell that story and someone who lived that reminds us of it, or somebody else brings an experience and they tell the story of why that matters, and that becomes a funny minhag, a custom in the community, then it belongs to all of us. But what I appreciate about that story is that there's someone in the back who says, like, what, I'm not a part of this thing that everyone's doing. I don't know what that's about. And already that means that I'm outside. So that anchor to me has to be telling our stories so that we can share in something, even if it's not our lived experience, we can understand someone else's lived experience, and then we can share the Jewish story together simply by having been connected to one another.
And I think that there are a couple of ways that that exact kind of logic, that exact kind of philosophy is shown in this Torah portion. So first we have, and we've already talked about the bones of Joseph, that Moses is carrying with him Joseph's bones. Joseph, who had died like 500 years ago, Moses never met. None of the people living had ever met Joseph. Even at the beginning of the Exodus, at the beginning of this narrative, we read, then came a Pharaoh who didn't know Joseph. So we know by this point, Joseph is long all but forgotten. And yet, we still have his bones and we carry them forward. And we know that the Hebrew, Atzmot Yosef, etzem doesn't necessarily just mean bone or limb. It can also be the substance of a thing. It can be the inner self, philosophical self of a thing. And so I think that there's something really incredible there about we don't have the body of Joseph. We don't have the mind of Joseph. We don't have the dreams or the stories or the whatever of Joseph at this point, but we have his bones. We have that substance there. And so I'm wondering if that can be carried forward, this spark that you're talking about, whether you talk about the spark as, you know, the Pintala Yid or as some form of collective memory. Speaking of memory, I have to say the one thing that sticks out to me about memory is always song. I think music is more connected to memory than pretty much anything else. To share a personal story, my grandmother, a couple of years ago, died after suffering from Alzheimer's for a number of years. And by the end, she mostly knew who I was, didn't remember my name, but knew who I was to her. And if I were to start singing any Gilbert and Sullivan song, she knew every single word. It was insane. I don't understand how that's possible. Like, for a person without Alzheimer's, I don't understand how that's possible. But she knew every word. And so I think about this Song of the Sea when we get to first the people individually saying, Ashira, Ladonai, I will sing. And then later on, after that whole song, Miriam saying, hey, all of you, sing, keep singing. I'm curious about both carrying the bones forward, carrying that spark, that Pintala Yid, and also turning it into song, turning some kind of, it's almost a mnemonic of here's how we're going to remember this thing that happened. So I'm curious how we think the Song of the Sea is a celebratory moment. Is it a teaching tool? Is it both? What's going on there? We're all just pointing at each other right now. That's what's happening.
I think that there are moments when, and maybe this is one of them, when at first you're speechless, first I'm speechless, and then something happens. For me, that's a real musical moment. The spontaneity of it, the expression of it, no one ever asked, and here you have, what, 600,000 people on the other side of the Red Sea ready to sing. I want to know if there was that person who comes to services and says, oh, I can't sing. I'm not going to sing. To me, this Ashira is a kind of, this kind of singing at the Red Sea is a gotta dance kind of moment. You know, you have no choice, but look at what just happened to you. If you can make any sound at all, I don't know that it would even have words. And we can talk about Nigunim now, this wonderful art, Jewish art, and I'm sure it's not just Jewish, but folk art of having melodies that have no words when we don't have the words. But we have that rhythm that makes us want to move, that makes us want to shout out this expression of joy from what we're experiencing in the moment. And I think that music has the ability to channel that. And again, you don't have to have a good voice. I'd love to talk about how everything in the whole universe is always singing. If only we turned on our receivers, if only we had the power to hear it all the time, is let's not forget, you know, there's no such thing as tone deaf in this kind of singing. I'm sure of that.
It's interesting to think about, like, what that call either from Miriam was for everyone to sing. And, you know, I think we put a lot of, in a good way, we put a lot of our own hopes and dreams and instincts onto that moment. You know, when she picked up her timbrel, as you said, you know, whatever that is, and people came and danced. I mean, it doesn't say that it was everyone, to Ellen's point. I said there have to be people who were overcome, who were scared, who had lost their family in the multitudes, you know. I mean, I think sometimes it's easy for us or easier to imagine that we all sort of share an experience because we want it to be shared. But the diversity, I mean, that's part of why I think about storytelling, is everybody's experience of that moment had to have been different. So there's both the, did everyone actually sing with Miriam? Or perhaps even everyone was having a different experience, but Miriam acted as the way to gather everyone to at least share an acknowledgement of that something had happened. So maybe not everyone was dancing joyously and some were crying or some were confused, minds blown, but that coming together in song, even if not everybody sang, was a way to create a sense of connectivity to each other and togetherness, even when we had singular experiences. I mean, that's to me what communal worship is. It's not that we all share the same experience. It's that we all have individual experiences in a collective. It's why it's so damn hard, right? Because everyone's experience is their own, but we share it next to with others. It's the only thing that we do like that in Jewish life, where we ask people to like be uniquely their own, but in front of others. So maybe that's what that moment was at the sea, that she called for people to gather and used song as a way to have people find their footing with each other again, even if the internal experience was radically different. And the power of that, I think that happens in our communities. It happens when folks gather in meaningful gatherings, when they sing. It's not, we're not like, you know, robots, all automatons having the same experience. Each experience is our own, but there's a sharing in it with something, perhaps like a song, or listening to it. Even if I'm not singing, I'm hearing it, I'm present to it. That's sort of how I like, how I now imagine that moment. I didn't when I was younger, but how I like to think about it now.
It's always interesting to me because when these big moments are about to happen or may have just happened, often you have God saying to the protagonist of our story, right? Altira, like Altiri, like don't be afraid. That's really fascinating is in our portion, Moses says to the people, Altira, ooh, like all y'all, don't be afraid. It's going to be okay. And what's fascinating is Moses is the one that then, you know, with God's instruction, raises the staff and starts our split, you know, and unless we're really in the Nachshon Ben Aminadav camp, that Nachshon like was a volunteer leader who took the first steps forward to get the ball rolling, which as any good leader knows, you need that good second, you know, in command volunteer to start moving us along. So I like to believe that that's true. I do think it's so beautiful that then in turn, it shows that there's always partnership in leadership. And I've been finding that more and more that in our stories, often it's a relationship, a partnership that makes the leadership really strong and really special. And so for people who are kind of going out into this world and trying to understand their best leadership abilities, or even when you're trying to lead a crowd of people who are maybe disinterested or, you know, just even I would say maybe at this point distraught, what advice might you have for an emerging leader who is trying their very best to make sure that everybody knows that it'll be okay in the end?
Well, I think as you said, with the portion specifically, I think for many of us, all of us who do this work, is to find those partners who, like the ones who held up Moses' arms, who can stand with you and support you in the work that you're doing. Particularly for any kind of leaders, there's this assumption that it falls solely on the leader's shoulders or we alone have to stand up and guide the group. I think that, and I observe it at least in our Jewish community now as it continues to evolve and maybe perhaps more rapidly, maybe to some it feels like it's happening very rapidly. I think if we're able to take a long view, it's always been this way, but a sense that many communities can be led by multiple people, that more participants in community living want to have agency in what happens. So there's a shared leadership. So I think the model of the single leader who has to, you know, even with Moses and Nachshon, maybe if that story was told differently, or maybe there are lots of folks all along the river might have put their foot in the water. You know, we just didn't hear their stories, right? Or when they got to the other side, a lot of people, maybe little groups were picking up everywhere. You know, there was, you know, one group and two shuls. I don't know, but like there were maybe people spread all out, picking up instruments, singing songs, hugging each other. I think that we have to consider that there isn't just one leader or one way to do Jewish, to be in a space that lives Jewish values and that has energy rooted in our text and our tradition, whether you're, you know, adjacent or participating in a community for the first time. I think we can take the pressure off ourselves. We're all part of that building. Everyone's going to cross that sea and have to have an experience of it, regardless of who might have said, let's go and like follow my staff. Everybody has to step into it themselves and have agency. So it's not just about the participants, but I think we as leaders have to really rethink what it is to lead and find more people to hold up our arms and to build those spaces with us.
I recently heard the quotation, change happens at the pace of relationship, that it is about the relationship between the leader and the group that, and we see this in Torah, and we see it all the time now, that trust is an enormous thing. And not the trust that the leader knows the absolute wonderful solution to every single problem or question, but that I have enough trust in you, I have enough experience of you creating a space where I feel safe, where community can be built, where change can happen in a healthy way. I trust you enough to go there with you and to be part of that change, because you've built an arc. You've built an arc in which, and you've called me on it, and I feel like it may not be smooth sailing, but at least I'm in an arc. So we trust our leaders. And I think that if leaders are transparent, I think it musically, if leaders trust the group to, you know, in terms of call and response, in terms of realizing what we all have in common, of realizing what the music can do with our help, then that's how we use our tools. Music is a tool, like say, to motivate change, to create change, to inspire it. And trust is right there.
Ellen, as you said at the beginning of this conversation could go on for months. And I think we would all have fun. But we don't have that kind of time. And so I do have to wrap up this conversation. But I do want to ask both of you, if you had one piece of wisdom, one call to action, one thing you would want your listeners to walk away with after listening to this episode, give us a few bars. What are you thinking? What's your message?
I would say for all people, really, if everyone could find places where they were able to sing with other people, to find places to bring their voice and to build spaces where other people's voices were welcome. Again, it doesn't always mean that we have to be singing. We can be listening or be receiving in many ways, but places where there's resonance, where the air changes with the vibration of people contributing sound. I think if we can create spaces for anybody to find their story is being told, the music and the community is open and representative of all of the various places we come from and not a single tradition, that would be my call to action, is to get out there and be with people who are making meaningful music and be in those spaces and see what emerges.
I love to quote Pete Seeger, who says, it's not whether music is good or bad, is what is it good for? And I mentioned just a second ago that music is an instrument. Music is a tool. And I'd also think that I'd like people to feel as if their song is unique, that a song, a personal song, and being able to sing it on musical notes are two very different things, that it's not just about being able to sing, but it's being able to express oneself in harmony and in conjunction with others. Musical notes, music is not the stuff on the page. Music happens in real time when the notes come off the page and they live in relation to each other. There's a wonderful Hasidic story, and I do not know the source, but it says that musical notes have a life of their own. I learned this from Rabbi Nechemya Polan, that musical notes have a life of their own, and that each note in a piece of music turns to the note in front of it. That note turns around and says, I give you permission to be more beautiful than me. And that note in turn turns to the next note and says, I give you permission to be more beautiful than me. And we have to be in relationship to each other. We have to be spurring each other on and inspiring each other. It's the combinations. It's the harmony. It's the variety of rhythm. It's the cultural styles that Rosalie mentioned. There's no one way to sing anything. And it's a reason for celebration. May it always be so, you know? May we always be celebrating this crazy diversity, harmony, atonal expression.
Yay, Yai, la, la, la. Yai, la, la, la. Miriam, Miriam. Bim, hey, ra. Bim, hey, ra. La, lam, dinu. Na, lam, dinu. Riku, dai. Riku, dai. Yai, lai, 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 lai.
Quick reminder, the Israelites arrived at a place called Bitter, creatively named for its bitter water. The people bitterly bicker about the bitter, bitter water, but don't worry, the bitter bickering about the bitter water of Bitter is made better when Moses finds a stick to put in the bitter water in Bitter. So I guess you could say the timber of Bitter betters the bitter bickering over the bitter, bitter beverage. Ha ha ha. So, for this week on Midrashic Mixology, we present the bitter, bitter beverage. Start off with 2 ounces of tequila, because there's a lot going on in Beshalach, and I kind of need a drink. Next up, 1 ounce of Grand Marnier, because God's miracles are pretty grand. For the titular bitterness, 1 ounce of fresh lemon juice for the bitter water of Bitter. Finally, a 1/4 ounce of honey for that sweet, sweet manna in the wilderness. Shake it up first without ice to get the honey fully dissolved, then add in a bunch of ice and shake until fully chilled. Pour it over fresh ice like the drowned Egyptians and garnish with a lemon wheel for the wheels of Pharaoh's chariots. For a non-boozy bitter bitter, omit the tequila, shaking together 1/4 ounce of honey with 1 each of grapefruit juice and lemon juice, topping off with 2 ounces of orange seltzer after shaking. You'll enjoy this beverage because it tastes great, so raise a glass and say L'chaim.
L'chaim.
Amen.
Nice. Love it.
And you've tried this drink? Like, for reals, if I go make this drink, it's going to be...
It'll be excellent.
I want to know how many taste tests you went through first on each of these drinks.
And do you, and is tequila, like, not great for you? Because as we noticed, said Ellen and I are... our fans.
No, here's the thing, is I like tequila. Tequila doesn't always like me very much.
Tequila's a fickle lover.
You know, that's a really great way to put it. I think we could say tequila is an ish milchama. You know, sometimes saving us, but also, you know, hurling some Egyptians into the sea. That metaphor kind of went off the rails there, but I'm sticking to it.
It's Beshalach, anything goes.
Well, now I know what they were dancing to on the other side, right? You only need tequila.
Tequila.
Oh, Ziv Zimrat Yah, Vayhili Lishua.
Gabe, I don't even know what to say. As I mentioned when we were off recording, that the Ish Milchama comment broke me a little bit. But I'm always down for a challenge. I'm always excited for the next thing that comes ahead. As I like to think, you know, everything is just a new grand adventure that we're about ready to face. And so, Rosalie, Ellen, Idan, Gabe, Moses says, Ashira, I'm going to sing. And Miriam says, Shiru, encouraging everyone to sing, that, you know, everyone around us should have a song. And so my question is, when you are about to face your new big challenge, your new grand big adventure, what's a song lyric or a melody that pumps you up? Rosalie, we'll start with you.
Well, I find that the things that I always find myself singing or always sing along to and that pump me up is almost all good classic rock. And often I find myself, or if it's ever playing somewhere, like, we are the champions, my friends. And you can't hear it. We'll keep on fighting. Like, you can't hear it and just, like, walk through the grocery store. You sing aloud. So any of those good power ballads, classic rock, pump me up, and I'm always singing every lyric along.
I love it. Ellen, what are you thinking about? What pumps you up when you're about ready for your next grand adventure?
Pump me up for my next grand adventure. That's a really tough one for me. For me, it's usually a Broadway tune. For me, it's, you know, Can You Hear the People Sing? It's Les Mis. It's the more intricate the harmonies. Oh, yeah, with the waving of the flags and the, I need something like that. I need, and it has to have at least four, possibly six or seven part harmonies. And I can't be singing the melody. I'm a harmony person. I only want to sing the harmony parts. So the louder I can sing, doesn't matter what the melody is. It just has to have lots of harmony.
Just lets you blast out. I love it, you know? And I love that you've actually said, right? Like, this is, it comes in relationship, that you do harmony in relationships to other singing. And so I think that's amazing. Gabrielle, that is Cantor Gabe Snyder.
Student Cantor. I'm a student. And speaking of being a student, I am in the process of proposing my thesis at HUC. My thesis being on the educational utility of the movie The Prince of Egypt. I'm sorry, the documentary The Prince of Egypt in teaching text and midrash. So I'm stupid excited about that. And to answer your question, Amanda, really any song in there, except for one of them, is a certified bop. And I love all of it. Playing with the big boys is just like a little silly. But every other song in there is a total just certified bop. Love it so much. Any song in the plague song is my ringtone. I love that entire soundtrack. And I'm excited to spend the next year listening to it on repeat and trying to find the midrash within.
Incredible. I'm so glad that you came up with this original idea all by yourself with no help whatsoever for your thesis.
Amanda helped a little bit with the conceptualization of this idea.
Incredible. Edan, what are you thinking about? What are you singing to yourself when a challenge is coming your way?
Well, when a challenge is coming my way, I'd say more so looking towards my next adventure, right? As we were putting it, I think that whenever I feel like I'm doing work that's like too out there and not consistent enough, and I need to just sort of do something like, and I just need a 9-to-5, you know, sometimes these things are just too wild and out there and I need to just like really rein it in. I think of the song by Corey Wong called Today I'm Gonna Get Myself a Real Job. I have a chord sheet right here. I'm not gonna do the whole song. I'm gonna do like the first verse and then the last verse, because the arc of the song is you know, being a musician is too tough. It's not consistent enough work. It could be really tough to break through. Looking at Spotify statistics and whatnot, specifically referenced in the song. But then coming to terms with the fact that I was always meant to be a musician. I'm going to play this and we'll see how it goes. Today I'm going to get myself a real job. Today it's time to be a standard working man. Oh, this music thing's been fun, but I think that I am done. Today I'm gonna get myself a real job. I'm contemplating getting on the payroll. No stress about what other people think. No ticket sales, no critics, or Spotify statistics. Today I'm gonna get myself a real job. Gonna fast forward to the last verse. I was never meant to have a real job. His passions burned inside since I was 12. Now I may not be the best, but I know that I can rest, knowing today that I don't ever need a real job. And so I really find a lot of inspiration in that song. And also, he's also not really a great singer. And so that's kind of his thing. He kind of has like a little bit of a Kermit voice. And so I really relate to that for that.
That might be the cutest thing I've ever heard. You know? I was really excited to share mine, except that like I'm not going to follow that up because I just don't think I have the ability. And so what I'll say is like for me, two that like I don't know if they speak to adventure, but they're always like an amp up for me is Build Me Up Buttercup by the Foundations is always one that's like, talk about harmony, right? You know, Ellen, like you can always have 8 million harmonies on that. And I have found that you can just stand in the middle of the street and like walk. And if you start singing, other people, you know, start singing with you because that's a bop. It's a song. And the other one is Love Song by Sarah Bareilles, because like she knows what she wants. She's ready. She's excited about it. And I feel very good about it, but I'm not going to sing it because I don't have guitar. And Edan just kind of nailed it. But I am so excited that we got to be in this conversation with you. And Ellen, Rosalie, other people also might want to be in conversation with you about what you've taught tonight and about music and about just the incredible leadership that you have brought to us. And also, I would say, to the Jewish people as a whole. And so, Ellen and Rosalie, if people are looking to find or follow you, how can they best be in contact?
Well, as you mentioned before, I got a website for consulting and spiritual direction and such things. And that's ellendreskin.com. And I hope that if people want to learn more, that come on over to the Light Lab podcast sometime that I do, that Eliana Light has invited me and Josh Warshawski to be in cahoots with her on that podcast. And it's a lot of fun and learning. And I can't wait to run into y'all again. This has been a real blast.
And you can find me and my residencies and teaching at rosaliewill.com and the nonprofit that I run, singuntogod.org, which brings people together to pipeline song leaders to build up a new generation of communal singers, people who want to learn more about dynamic worship, music, all of the creative things that are happening there. Sing Unto God is a wonderful place to start building some community. So I hope to see you on either place or anywhere on Facebook. You can find me and Ellen.
Incredible. We are so grateful to have had you both on the podcast this evening. It has been an extraordinary night of teaching, and I would say even just music, and really also Midrash coming in and being able to give some interpretation and finding ways to make the text tangible, right? As both of you were saying, we change and the tradition changes with us, and making sure that we keep it relevant and resonant for where we are today really matters. And so we are so grateful to you. Gabe, thank you so much for your tongue twisting, you know, short Torah summary, and also your drink, which, you know, Rosalie might try, but is a little skeptical because I think she might like her tequila a little purer than you made it. And I will say, Edan, thank you for stepping out of your comfort zone. You sang for the people tonight. We can't believe it. We're so excited that you did that. And of course, thank you to our editor, Mike, for making us sound so pretty. And to all our listeners, we'll be with you soon.
I could listen to Ellen and Rosalie talk and sing all day. Like, I just want to sit down and have conversations with them about music, about leadership, about theology. Both of them have just such great insight and experience and just a wealth of knowledge. One of the things that I think is interesting that we didn't touch on, that is to say, it's interesting that we did not touch on, is Exodus chapter 15, verse 11, which is probably, at least in Jewish circles, the most well-known part of the Song of the Sea. Mi kamocha ba'elim Adonai, mi kamocha nedar bakodesh nora tehilot osefele. Who is like you, Eternal One, among the gods? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome, terrible, tremendous in splendor, working wonders? There's something really incredible about this idea of God working wonders. And whether we see God as Ish Milchama, this God of destruction and chaos and death, or we see God as this redemptive savior figure, we can still recognize the wondrousness of this Torah portion. And I think that something that really stuck out to me, at least in this conversation, was this discussion of what happens when a community comes together in song. Because each person has their own song that they're singing. They each have their own kavana, their own intention, their own inner thoughts as they're singing. And yet when the people sing together, even if they have different thoughts behind that song, something greater is created. There's something wondrous about that. There's something majestic about that. There's something holy about that. So I hope that no matter what kind of theology we subscribe to, no matter what our song is, that we can keep singing it in community as we keep marching forward. L'chaim.
L'chaim.
Hi, I'm Cantor Ellen Dreskin, and you're listening to Drinking and Droshing, Torah with a Twist. And you say tequila, I say tefillah. Just put on your rain hats and your galoshes, and let's go cross us some seas.